Speaking of Deltaville, before I moved here, I lived for about 5 years in Deltaville. It's a small town in Virginia. Deltaville has a population of about 1,200 and a county of 10,000. It's located at the tip of a narrow strip of land that's bounded on the two long sides by the Rappahannock and the Piankatank rivers, and at the narrow tip end by the Chesapeake Bay. So until about the 1960s, describing Deltaville as isolated would have been something of an understatement. Bridges across the rivers replacing the ferries and the affordability of automobiles had changed much of that by the time I arrived around the year of 2000. But for a born and bred city girl, I confess that I still felt at times that I was living in a different world. Let me be clear, though, for a community to be geographically isolated is not necessarily a bad thing. If you're from a town like Deltaville, you undoubtedly know that for every downside, there is an equal or greater upside. One of those upsides was the number of old family homes scattered throughout the town, homes in which many generations of the same family had been born and lived and died. Sadly, those homes are now vanishing, many sold to newcomers, attracted by the waters of the bay and by a different pace and style of life. More and more in Deltaville and other towns like Deltaville, visits to grandmother or grandfather no longer take place at the family home. They take place at an assisted living or nursing home. And unfortunately, along with the disappearance of these family homes, there's been a real decreasing sense of connectedness, of roots in many people's lives. When families do gather for a family meal, it's often at the local restaurant, in this case, Taylor's, instead of at a home that has that sense of the family and generations past being present with us. So that comfort of those generations past is somehow being lost. I think this lack of sense of connection, this lack of sense of roots, is even more important and more apparent in an area like the Triangle. I tried this morning. Let's see what happens now. How many people here today were born and raised in Cary? What can I say? That was the same thing that happened in the early service. I don't see a single hand. Maybe that's why people today find it hard to realize that at this table, in this place, we are truly surrounded by generations past. The family that encircles us here is the family of faith. If you start counting with Abraham, our roots go back, give or take 4,000 years or so. It's almost 2,000 years ago that Jesus and his disciples gathered to celebrate the Passover just before he was arrested, tried, and executed. So when we gather to eat the bread and drink the cup, we are surrounded by our Jewish brothers and sisters who call Abraham father, and by Peter, James, and John who call Jesus Lord. And wonderfully, for many of us, by our own mothers and fathers who came to church and remembered the Lord and received communion and passed it on to us. What a rich heritage we do have if only we can learn to recognize and claim it. And now, I didn't forget this, it is time to hear the words that Jesus had to say to the disciples when they gathered for communion that day. I'm reading from Matthew, the 26th chapter, beginning with verse 26, and I think you'll find these words familiar. While they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to the disciples, and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will never again drink of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's." time and place did know about heritage. This reading, of course, is the story of the last meal that Jesus shared with his disciples. Matthew says they observed the ritual of the Passover meal. That means they would have remembered the covenant that God had made with Moses, celebrating the event of the Passover and recognizing all that God had done for God's people in the years since. And by the way, make no mistake, it was a full Passover meal. It was not just a loaf of bread and wine. I imagine that they ate and drank and talked and probably questioned and maybe even laughed a little, or shared sorrow and fear of the unknown future together. And that's when Jesus made use of those ordinary elements, the bread and the wine that were present at pretty much every meal, to speak to his disciples of a new covenant. Now, those words that I just read are so familiar to us. We hear them or similar words from Luke or from Paul each Sunday when we come to the table. And in taking communion every Sunday, most modern disciples are following the pattern of the early Christians. I don't know how you feel about it, but I know that if I am visiting a church which does not observe communion on Sunday morning, when I leave, I feel just a little bit of a lack, a sense of emptiness, something not quite complete. And yet, I wonder sometimes, is there a risk for us in coming to the table every week? Can we get too efficient at passing the trays and moving on to the next part of the service? Do we really hear the words of institution each week and take them in? Can this become so routine that we fail to experience it as sacred? Does this act of worship change us and change the way we live? This sense of familiarity with the text concerned me when I began to prepare to speak with you this morning. Quite honestly, I would never have chosen this text to preach from, because it's hard to preach from texts that we know so well, hard to imagine that fresh insights are going to be there for us. But I kept reading and rereading Jesus' words, and somehow I kept focusing on one phrase: "This is my blood of the covenant." Now for me, that sense is what I call a God nudging. When something grabs my attention and I can't quite let go of it. And so I kept digging and exploring and reading about that word covenant. The Hebrew word covenant, or that which is commonly translated as covenant, generally referred to a formal agreement or treaty between parties. It could be between individuals, it could be between families, between tribes, and eventually between nations. The original primitive way of concluding a covenant, of sealing the covenant, was for the parties to cut each other's arms and suck the blood, the mixing of the blood, rendering them brothers of the covenant. Now, I wasn't looking too closely, but I can tell you in the early service there were some scrunched up faces when I described that. We kind of feel this aversion to that idea, and I think it was in the time as the years went by that aversion was probably what changed this process. And what happened next was they began to use sacrificial animals. The animal would be cut in two, and the two parties would walk a path between — it might be more than one animal, but they would walk in a path between these two parts of the animals, and that was the sealing of the contract. And this was to show that the two parties were bound to each other. The meat would then be eaten in a meal, which also reiterated the same idea. So eventually, the eating and drinking of the meal became in itself a means of covenanting. The act was solemnized by the invocation of the deity in an oath also. It was possible for a covenant to be not between equal parties, but to be imposed by a greater party upon a lesser one. For example, a king might offer protection to a, a tribe or a group of people, and the expectation was that they would offer loyalty. The biblical covenant at Sinai, the covenant with Moses and the people who had been led out of Egypt, was that kind of a covenant between a greater power and a lesser power. God said to the people, "Now therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation." So loyalty to God was to be demonstrated in the form of obedience to the laws. The Mosaic covenant was actually sealed in the blood of animal sacrifices. Check it out, it's in Exodus 24. And this was a covenant under which the Jews of Jeremiah's day and of Jesus' day continued to live. Some of the texts, when you read the words in Matthew, actually read, "This is my blood of the covenant," and some read, "This is my blood of the new covenant." And this is the way the words of institution are often repeated, using that phrase, "the new covenant." The only mention in the Hebrew Bible of a new covenant after the Mosaic covenant occurs in our reading from Jeremiah. And this is what Jeremiah says in the 31st chapter. "The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, says the Lord. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. No longer shall they teach one another or say to each other, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, says the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more." One writer says of this passage, "Whereas laws which were written in stone can be broken and put aside, God's covenant in hearts is enduring. The new covenant brands us as God's people. It's an internal identity that will be evidenced by external behavior. We will live God's law not because we're obliged to, but because we want to, because our hearts are shaped that way. The capacity to be faithful and obedient will spring from the inside." The Hebrew word for put also means give. God will give the law to the people, and our hearts will recognize and accept and lift up the gift. Now, we can't know for sure that those words of the words of Jeremiah were in Jesus' mind when he ate with the disciples in the upper room. Certainly, though, those words would have been familiar to Jesus and would have influenced his thinking and the thinking of the disciples. Jesus knew his heritage. He knew about God and Moses and the people. He knew about blood covenants. He knew about the hope of a new covenant. Then he took a cup, and when he'd given thanks, he gave it to his disciples, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." So when we eat the bread and drink the cup, we become part of Jesus' covenantal family. The loaf and cup are visible signs to us of God's love and grace. And by eating and drinking, we commit ourselves to follow Jesus, to be faithful disciples. Faithful disciples. Faithful discipleship is about how we live, our actions, our external behaviors, about allowing our hearts to be shaped by God's law and God's will. You have the insert in your bulletin, and you can read along with me. I'm going to read part of it. "You might not expect an emphasis on faith and giving to begin with the story of Jesus and the disciples eating the Last Supper. what took place at that table in the upper room is at the heart of Christian life, with important implications for stewardship. The giving of the loaf and cup represent God giving pure, unbounded love to the church and to the world. When we eat the bread and drink the cup, we not only embrace God's love, we also make a commitment to live in love. I'm going to repeat that last sentence. When we eat the bread and drink the cup, we make a commitment. We not only embrace God's love, we make a commitment to live in love. We say to God, in essence, I embrace your love as the basis for my life, and I commit myself to participating with you in helping this world become more like the realm that you desire for us and for all. How do we do that? Well, part of a life of faithful discipleship means becoming faithful stewards. Our God is a generous giving God, and we are intended to mirror that generous giving spirit here on earth. Living a life of love means sharing the money, the time, the energy, the talents which God gives us. The new covenant is one of relationship between God and me and you and all of God's creation. As the next few weeks of our stewardship emphasis unfolds, please pray that God will give each of us that spirit of generosity which mirrors God's own.